Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 10-173, State v. DeMello. Arguing for the petitioner, Artemio Boxa. Arguing for the respondent, Audrey Stanley. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed today? All right, and Mr. Boxa, you've reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. Stanley, we'll give you a five-minute warning, and we've authorized you to argue from your seat in view of your injury there. So please, no need to stand up when you address the court. You just remain seated throughout the argument. Good. Mr. Boxa, please proceed.
May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice Rectenor, other members of the court, counsel, Mrs. Stanley. My name is Artemio C. Boxa. I represent the state in this case. We respectfully submit that in this case, the ICA erred in concluding that lost wages are not compensable as restitution.
First of all, Mr. Boxa,
yes.
Is this really lost wages or is it income?
Yeah. The issue that we are concerning in this case, Justice, is about the lost wages.
Is it wages, though? She's not employed. She's self-employed, and it's actually...
Lost wages.
Okay, so you characterize wages as including her income
including
as a self-employed hairdresser. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
The ICA found that the award of lost wages is contrary to the intent of the SRS 706-646. And it said that there is no explicit provision in that statute awarding lost wages as a part of restitution. Our analysis begins with the provision of SRS 706-646-2, subsection 2, and subsection 2. In that section, the statute provides that the court shall award restitution, compensation to the victim for reasonable and verified losses.
All right, Mr. Boxa, I hate to harp on this issue, but I really want to clarify here. The trial judge did not call it lost wages, correct? The trial judge referred to it as loss of gross receipts, correct?
I just want to be clear about the question.
Right.
You're saying that the issue is not about lost wages.
I'm saying that is it really fair or true to call it wages? The trial judge called it loss of gross receipts. And as you say, the statute provides for reasonable and verifiable losses, right? The reason I ask this is the trial judge talks about loss of gross receipts. As a self-employed hairdresser, she sits there, and I guess based on her schedule, all the clients that she had lined up and the whatever she was scheduled to do for them, she had that was the basis for the gross receipts, correct? But actually, as a self-employed hairdresser, and I think you know many of us go to hairdressers that do it this way, they rent a chair, right, at the salon. And they receive gross receipts. If I pay $90 for a hair color shampoo cut, right? But the hair stylist also has to pay out things. Like she has to pay for her own hair coloring or the shampoo that she uses. So this gross receipts does not actually reflect her verifiable losses because there's no deduction for her cost for these receipts, correct?
Justice Pekana, I understand the question now.
Okay.
The only reason I mention about lost wages is that the ICA used that term in their decision.
Okay.
But I understand the question The question pertains to the receipts, pertains to the lost wage by the victim in this case.
Right.
In this case, Honorable Justices of the Supreme Court, the ICA itself did not question that finding of the trial court that the only one who caused the loss in this case was the defendant, and there was sufficient evidence to prove that she suffered this loss. And that is, and under the testimony that was presented here, the standard set by the law, first, as Justice McKenna mentioned, first, reasonable and verified losses. Was it reasonable? Was it verified? We say that it is, as concluded by the ICA. Reasonable because this was the result of the offense of the defendant, and reasonable because she was incapacitated for work from May the 13th to May the 23rd, a question of 10 days. She was a hairdresser, and verified losses under Exhibit A, which was presented to the court. And by the way, the court found credible the testimony of the witness in this case. And Exhibit A consisted of those appointments by the victim in this case, along with the wages that she would be getting. And there was a stipulation. While the defense did not stipulate that would be the truth, it did stipulate that that is what the victim would testify to. So I found, we would argue, Your Honor, that in fact it was a verified loss. Now, I am going to the meat of what the ICA said, that it was not a compensable part of restitution under the statute. The second sentence on that subsection 2 of 706-646-2 says that the court shall award compensation for what was suffered by the victim as a result of the action of the defendant. No, that's not what I wanted to say. That shall award compensation to be paid to this. To the commission, to the, used to be the civil injuries compensation. Now, yeah, civil injuries compensation. That amount had to be paid to the commission if the court awards compensation under section 351, chapter 351. And I would like to reiterate to the court that under chapter 351, under subsection 2, it awards it allows the compensation for loss of earning power of the victim for total or partial incapacity. And under subsection 3 of chapter 351, it also awards other compensation as a direct result of the injury suffered by the victim.
So what about pain and suffering? Could a court, because the Crime Victim Compensation Commission is allowed to make awards for pain and suffering, does that mean that a court can order restitution for pain and suffering?
Which one is that, Chief Justice?
It's subsection 4. Chief Justice is referring to 351.33, subsection 4.
So in other words, if you look at the different things that the Crime Victim Compensation Commission can order order compensation with regard to. You've cited 351.33.2, which is loss to the victim of earning power. However, 351.33.4 provides for awards for pain and suffering. So my question is, does that mean that a court could provide a restitution award for pain and suffering under your analysis of the statute?
For pain and suffering, Chief Justice, we would argue that it would be covered if it is a direct result of the injury.
How is pain and suffering verifiable? How is pain and suffering verifiable? Is it subjective or is it verifiable?
I would say it is verifiable.
Let me ask you this, another question. 351.33 appears in part three of the criminal injuries compensation commission, you know, the fund area. 351.32 says the crimes to which part three of this chapter applies are the following and no other. And it lists various crimes, and it added a few more that's in the supplement. But I understood that this conviction was for harassment under 711-1106. I don't see harassment under 711-1106 listed as one of the crimes for which the CVCC would apply. And if one of the arguments of the state is that, you know, because 707-746, the portion that says if the CVCC orders payment, then it the restitution shall include what the CVCC orders, and that allows for loss of earning power, it wouldn't apply to this crime, correct?
Yeah,
of harassment?
Justice McKenna, it is true that under Chapter 351, these are for violent crimes, enumerated violent crimes, and it does not include harassment. Harassment is the case in this case. But nevertheless, harassment is also a crime for which the defendant is liable for.
I understand, but in terms of relating 351.33 to this case, it doesn't apply because harassment is not a crime for which you can obtain compensation under the CVCC.
Do I understand, Justice, that you are saying that under Chapter 351, one is entitled to loss of earning power only under Chapter 351 and not under 706-646?
Right. I'm just saying we can't look at 351.33 in peri materia in this case because it's a harassment conviction to which 351.33 does not apply. So we have to evaluate this just under 707-746, the statute.
We would submit, Your Honor, that that would be giving two standards of justice for in the criminal justice system for violent crimes enumerated under this and for crimes under this. And what we are saying is this. The Crime Victim Compensation Act was enacted in 1967. When the legislature enacted 706-642-643, this was in 1976. Presumably, when the legislature enacted subsequently in 1998, this statute that we are concerned now, the legislature is presumed to know the existing law, and that existing law provided for compensation of loss of earning power.
So why didn't they copy the language? If they wanted to pay for things like lost income, lost wages,
Justice Pollack, if I may intervene a little bit.
Well, let him finish his, if you would, Mr. Boxer, please let the justice finish his, let him finish his question.
His voice a little
bit. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Sorry, yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much, Justice Pollack.
You're right, my mic was way over, thank you. Now, my question was just going to be, and I agree with you, they knew what was in 351.33, and if they wanted to, it would have been so simple to just copy the language that was there. They knew it was there. If they wanted to cover lost income, lost wages, or any other pecuniary loss, they could have just used the same language. But the legislative history shows clearly why they didn't.
Beg your pardon, the legislature took that out, the language.
In other words, your argument, you just stated that the legislature is presumed to know the other statutes that were in existence at the time in 1998, and I agree with you. But one of the things they would have been aware of is that the 351.33 specifically covered things like pain and suffering and any other pecuniary loss. But they didn't incorporate that language into the victim restitution statute in 706. And the reason they didn't is very, very clear in the legislative history, which everyone here is aware of.
Justice Pollack, I would argue respectfully to the court that even though if that language was not there, again, the first standard set under 706, 646.2 is reasonable and verified losses. And now comes under 706, 646, subsection 3, the restitution shall be for a dollar amount sufficient. We have to be very careful about reading the language there. Sufficient to fully reimburse the victim fully for losses.
For the losses,
to harp on the words sufficient and fully.
For the losses enumerated.
Fully, and then it says, including but not limited to, and then it says, medical and so on. We realize, Your Honor, that in the House Committee, originally in the first House Committee report, there was that section about lost wages. Recovery of lost wages, and they eliminated that. However, along the process of legislative deliberations, there were subsequent committees that came in. First, it went to the Senate Judiciary Committee, then it went to the Ways and Means Committee. Under the Ways and Means Committee, they in fact deleted the word fully. They deleted the word fully, saying that it may be an overreaching to include everything. But ultimately, Your Honors, when it came to the last committee, the conference committee, they reinserted the word fully.
But not lost wages.
Not lost wages.
So fully applies to the enumerated categories.
Yeah. Your Honor, this is the way how I would respectfully argue. They did not put the lost wages, but that does not mean that they did not, that the statute itself, read as a whole. And of course, I do not have to expound to you the rulings of the court about statutory construction,
but
you know.
Mr.
I know only a part of it, and you know everything about that.
Mr. Boxer.
And the language of the statute should be the main criteria. The fact that the lost wage is not there, examine the statute as well. And to me, reasonable, verified losses, fully, there are very important, significant words. And the words after that, including but not limited to. Including but not limited to means an enumeration of examples, not limited to those that are under it. Is it within the ambit of the statute?
Mr. Boxer, if we accept...
And especially
Mr. Boxer, I think Justice Pollack had a question, I think.
If we accept your interpretation of fully,
That means fully means everything. And if it means everything, then all the enumerated categories are superfluous. It also gets us back to Chief Justice's question. If fully means everything, it means pain and suffering. It means everything. The entire statute means every possibility. And why would they enumerate categories? Why would they use words like including but not limited, which gets back to the statutory principle that words of a feather flock together. And what's there are expenses.
I would still respectfully maintain that the word fully means the word itself.
If restitution is supposed to be a quasi-civil remedy, does restitution as a remedy under the civil, in a civil context, ever include pain and suffering? Isn't restitution actually limited to actual expenses?
Yeah, Justice McKenna, I would like to respond to that. That the law allows a victim to file an action in civil court for recovery. But they said that this is costly and time-consuming, and so they allow that adjustment of the criminal court in restitution be a part of the civil and could be enforced as a civil judgment.
Right, so, I understand that. What so I'm saying, though, is...
They wanted to fast-track. They wanted to eliminate this costly and time-consuming litigation.
I understand that, but to the extent that an argument is, one of the arguments against the state's position is that the Civil Victims Compensation Fund statute allows for pain and suffering, and so wouldn't then fully include restitution for pain and suffering. I'm suggesting that, and I'm wondering what the state's position is, does restitution usually include pain and suffering? Is it restitution actually limited to actual expenses under civil law if this criminal restitution statute is supposed to be a quasi-civil remedy?
I understand the question, Justice McKenna, but again, I would like to submit that all the committee reports did say that, in a civil litigation, probably is the proper place where this extensive examination and bringing out about restitution damages, other things that are more complex could be litigated. But then they said it's costly.
Right. So what I'm trying to, I understand the ICA used the word lost wages, and I think wages are actually verifiable because wages are usually pretty well set. But in terms of reasonable and verified losses, for example, what if someone was an independent contractor and had jobs lined up. Let's say that, you do yard work as an independent contractor and you were scheduled to do yard work the next day and you get, and, let's say that the person, they provide all of the equipment and all the pesticides and everything or whatever you might have to use. And so you don't have to use any of your own things. You just go and actually do the labor. And you were supposed to get paid $100 the next day. How is that not a verified reasonable and verified loss?
Thank you, Justice McKenna. It may be true that pain and suffering are harder to prove, but let me go back to my argument. My argument is this. The victim in this case was not able to go to work for 10 days. She was incapacitated. She could not get up. She was so painful in the neck. She could not stand long. It's not about really pain and suffering. It is about the inability to resume her vocation, her work. That is what the judge awarded this. And if we read the decision of the sentencing judge, restitution judge, this is why the judge awarded this, because she was not able to go to work. She was not able to get up.
But we get back to Justice McKenna's earlier questions, which was all the expenses that go into making the income. In other words, she has to buy supplies.
She has to
buy supplies, right, to do her job. She has to drive there, so she has the mileage. She has to perhaps parking. When we start getting into all the various associated costs for someone like this, even with someone with lost wages, aren't we talking about all the different types of insurance, workers' comp, unemployment? We're talking all kinds of things. In fact, that's why the commission requires you to submit those kind of data to them. Right. And because she didn't go to work, we don't know how much money she actually would have made, because we don't know how much expenses went into making her income.
But you had the exhibit there, where she had the appointments. She had the amounts that she would be receiving for certain appointments. And the judge received that.
Well, Mr. Boxa, can I just ask you one question? Your position is that her lost income was reasonably demonstrable and verified in this case. Is that correct?
Precisely.
Okay.
Now, Chief Justice.
Okay. Now, precisely. If there are, would you agree? Is there a middle ground where one could say, as long as these types of losses are in fact verifiable and can be ascertained with reasonable ease or reasonable definiteness, they could be compensable, but certain other category, if they're not able to be identified in such a manner, they would not be recoverable. So let me give you another example. Someone who suffers a grievous injury as a result of a crime, and the claim is that that person is totally or largely incapacitated, and there's a claim for future lost wages, and at that point, there would be a debate about how long that person was going to live, what their likely earnings were going to be during their lifespan, what the proper discount rate would be to present value. Would you agree that that kind of very complex analysis might be excluded, although the relatively straightforward analysis that you contend is relatively straightforward in this case could be compensable? Is there some kind of a line in the middle, or is it all or nothing?
Mr. Chief Justice, I don't know if I have expressed myself very clearly on this point. I agree with that. Because, see, again, under 706.646, reasonable and verifiable. See, if it is not verifiable, you know, it is not verifiable. She would not be entitled to compensation. But in this case, it was verified.
Is it verified?
That is our position.
If it's future, and we don't know how many of her customers may have shown up? Do we know if some of them would have canceled? She submitted a list of what she anticipated would be her customers. Do we know whether all of them would have shown up? Would there maybe have been cancellations?
We do not know, but the defense is stipulated that is what that complainant would testify to.
Right, but not to the truth of the test. The defense was pretty clear. The defense said, we'll stipulate that that's what you would testify, but not as necessarily that would be what the actual losses would be.
But, Justice Puller, I would like to point out here, though, that the ICA itself found, to me, the facts in that case about it's not an issue, because they found that there was a basis for that.
The ICA did not allow for this specific category we're talking about. They allowed it for other things.
Okay. Maybe I don't get it, but I hope I have made myself clear. I'm so sorry.
No, if you'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal, then we'll hear from Ms. Stanley at this point. Ms. Stanley, your argument. Oh, you probably should pull the mic right in front of you. Just in front of, there you go.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Audrey Sam.
first like to apologize for having to sit in the chair and wearing sandals.
No need at all, Ms. Stem. The court certainly understands and is happy to have you, as you argue from your seated position. That's fine.
Thank you.
No need to apologize.
We would argue that the ICA did not gravely err in determining that lost wages are not allowed or income.
How do you address this issue? This is really is not a wage loss claim.
I agree with you, Justice McKenna. Wages are usually determined by, if you're an employee, under, I believe, like accounting and the IRS, an employee receives wages while an independent contractor receives fees. There is a difference there. So we believe that in this, well, lost income are not allowed because the statute is ambiguous and the legislative history clearly indicates that lost wages should not be included. Second, Dr. Sylvie's Justin Generis indicates that it should not be included. And third, Lenny. My second argument is that even if the court determines that possibly lost wages or income could be allowed, it is not reasonable and verified in this case. And third, we would ask the court to possibly clarify a little bit of the ICA opinion, which seemed to suggest that the burden would shift. It could be read to suggest that the burden would shift to the defense. Turning to the first point now, though, as to lost wages, I believe it's clear that the statute is ambiguous. The term losses is not defined by statute. It's very ambiguous. If you just look at Black's Law Dictionary or the definition we cited in our opening brief, it can include a myriad of things, and it's ambiguous. So because it's ambiguous, you can consider the legislative history, and as was made evident, or as was previously discussed, the legislative history clearly showed that the legislature considered this option and expressly rejected it by taking it out of the statute.
But what about the reinsertion of the word fully, as argued by the state?
That was reinserted in the conference committee. When that was added, there was no explanation given as to why that was added. There was no express mention that we want to give lost income or lost wages. Nothing like that. They just reinserted it. If they wanted to include lost wages, they knew this was a discussion that was going on. They would have expressly included it in the statute. Including the word fully, that doesn't specify lost wages. And that doesn't mean that lost wages should have been covered. There was this entire debate going on and about lost wages. Lost wages was expressly taken from the statute and not put back in. And there was no discussion in the conference committee that we want to add it because we want lost wages. Nothing like that whatsoever. So that shouldn't.
So you're saying that, do you agree that the CVCC would not apply to this harassment conviction?
Yes.
Okay, so you're saying that a victim of harassment could not go to the CVCC and would be restricted to the restitution statute?
Yes, or any civil.
And so a victim of harassment would have to file a civil case in order to obtain compensation for even clear lost wages.
Yes, that would be my argument.
And you think that was the legislative intent?
I believe so. The legislature specifically said that was an area for the civil arena, not for criminal, because it is very difficult.
Why do you think the legislature wants to simplify things for victims of serious crimes, but not for victims of relatively minor crimes as petty as harassment is characterized?
Well, you could argue that there is a presumption if you have like serious disfigurement or loss of, or broken bones or something, as you know, under murder or those enumerated things, you will have loss of earning power.
So victims of less serious crimes should suffer more than victims of serious crimes. In other words, because if you're a victim of a serious crime, you can go to the CVCC and, you know, and get compensation for many things, including pain and suffering.
Yes.
And you don't have to file a civil lawsuit.
You don't have to. No one has to file a civil lawsuit. But even in the CVCC, the awards is capped at $10,000. So even if there's more than that in pecuniary loss or anything of like that nature, or mental health or mass casualty, that loss is limited to $10,000. So there's never really those offenses that are specifically enumerated, there's more of a likelihood for something that, that can be determined. Also, the CBCC has the right to appoint an examiner, a medical examiner, to determine certain types of things, either in incapacity presented the, or prevented the person from going to court. I mean, I'm sorry, going to work or something of that nature. In criminal courts, that is not likely. That possibly could be done, but either the criminal defense attorney or the state will be paying for this expert witness. And that's very difficult to do. I don't think that there is a victim of a petty misdemeanor is getting more hurt because they don't get lost wages. They always have the civil arena to follow that.
Isn't there the possibility also that when the legislature was thinking about this that CBCC doesn't have unlimited funds, and if you're going to have a limited amount of resources, that it might be better determination to expend those resources on people more seriously injured who are more likely to miss work than it would be to open it up to every single harassment charge where somebody may be claiming, despite the injury not even rising to the level of bodily injury or serious or substantial, to make a claim. I think it may just be a matter of making the most judicious use of resources.
And that's, I agree with you too. When the statute was amended in 1995, they expressly said that the CBCC was running out of money and they wanted to give more money to the CBCC. So I think that that's the reason, yeah, allocation of funds.
Well, what about the middle ground that I asked Mr. Box about? I'll ask you the same question. Why wouldn't the touchstone be whether the losses are reasonable and verifiable? And if, for example, somebody was a salaried employee and they suffered a absolutely uncontrovertible loss of salary of X dollars, why wouldn't that person be compensated under the statute under that test, while somebody whose loss involves a very complex calculation of future lost earning capability would not be compensated? But isn't there room for a middle ground as opposed to an all or nothing approach?
In your opinion, if I'm interpreting you correctly, you would be saying that the trial court would have discretion to determine whether the amounts claimed are reasonable or verifiable.
Right. And so some cases that might be, if I understand, you're arguing a categorical position, which would be absolutely no circumstances under which wage loss could be compensatable, even if the person was making an absolutely fixed amount of money, didn't have leave, had to take leave without pay from work, so their absolute rock solid $500, $100 a day, 5 days a week, 5 days out, absolutely no doubt that they lost $500, that person would not be compensated under your position. Is that, and I want to be sure I get your position correct, is that right?
Say a person, you know, missed work because they were injured. Well, they had been a bad employee previously, and because of that one day, in addition, it was a straw that broke the camel's back, and that person lost his job. Should that person now be compensated for all of those prior, or for losing his job and that earning capacity? It goes down a slippery slope of, and what is included in lost wages or loss of income? Is it Social Security? Is it driving to work? Is it mileage? Is it parking? Is it...
Well, what does verified losses mean in under the statute? You know, in the civil context, I think the collateral source rule might apply. But, you know, what if they did get workers' compensation or TDI or something? Or does the district court judge need to then have a full-blown hearing as to what the actual payments were? I'm just wondering how one would figure these things out.
Verify means to confirm or establish the truth or truthfulness of, to check or test the accuracy of or exactness of. It doesn't just mean taking the person's word for it. There must be a lot of other factors, documentation. In some cases, you might even need a doctor or someone, the employer, to come and testify.
But your position is, in this case, is in terms of the actual losses claimed here, you haven't really raised the issue that I was asking about in terms of whether these losses are actually verified losses.
That they definitely are not in this case. All she presented was a ledger, the dates of that, the 10-day period where she lost with the names written in. She testified that when she saw the restitution worker, that's when she wrote in the amounts. There was no evidence of how her prior income tax statements or WTs or how much she actually made per month. Furthermore, this is a hairdresser who my hairdresser, if she misses work because she's sick, she'll squeeze me in later. There's no evidence that she did not squeeze in these people that allegedly missed at a later point. Furthermore, there's no evidence whatsoever about she rents a chair. How was that rent determined? Is it based on the amount of the income that she makes? Is it a percentage or is it a full amount? There's just all of these factors that cannot make, in this case, it's definitely not verified. Just her testimony alone without anything more is insufficient.
But isn't, I'm sorry, please go ahead.
Isn't testimony a verification of an argument that the attorney made? Why would a person's testimony under oath not be considered verification of a legal argument?
Because in these kinds of cases, in all honesty, victims sometimes will exaggerate. They have
you don't have any evidence of that here. Why would a person's testimony, just a person's testimony, be considered a verification of an attorney's argument?
I apologize. What if the state argument?
Yes. You keep saying her word isn't enough. Her word isn't enough. Why isn't her word? If she has a ledger, just because you think victims are untrustworthy and you try to exaggerate, why wouldn't a ledger and her testimony be enough?
I apologize, because I believe that there must be more to prove her earnings during that period. Income statements, her W-2s, things that she filed to show how much income she usually makes, how much income she made during that, or during a month, the months prior to, or the months after to that, to see if that maybe that is reasonable and verifiable amount. This ledger, which her name's written over just over a 10-day period, if there was more over more time, or W-2s or something of that nature, and we specifically asked for tax, she was asked about taxes and things of that nature, but nothing was submitted.
But isn't the position, and again, I'm looking at all the statements of the legislature about its concern with providing full restitution to victims. When it added the word fully back in the conference committee, the conference committee's report states, so that restitution shall be a dollar amount sufficient to reimburse any victim fully for losses. So there's clearly an understanding of a policy judgment that victims should be fully compensated. Yet if I understand what I understand to be your all-or-nothing position, in this case, there would be no crime victim compensation claim because it was a harassment case, so not eligible. There would not, as a matter of law, be restitution. So the only remedy for the victim in this case would be a civil lawsuit to recover $1,155 in damages, which realistically is simply, I think, impractical or improbable to ever happen, that there'll be a lawyer willing to take a case for that amount of money, so that she'll be uncompensated. Is that consistent with the legislature's intent when it said we're adding the word fully back in to ensure that victims are reimbursed fully for losses?
However, I do believe it's consistent with the legislative intent, because there's a list, an enumerated list of three types of categories, which are basically expenses. If the legislature intended fully to cover everything, there would be no reason why to keep those three enumerated categories. That would mean if we
what is the word including but not limited to mean then? Is that superfluous or just gone away?
No, it's an example. There's under the doctrine of just in advance, you could when general words follow specific words in the statute, the general words are construed to embrace only objects similar in nature. That also goes the opposite way. And the case I'm relying on is holding the AIG Hawaii Insurance Company 113 Hawaii 996. So when specific words follow general ones, the application of the general term to things that are similar to those enumerated. So when they say including but not limited to, it's including things under the three classes that are listed, basically expenses. The purposes of legislative intent is...
Is a damage to property an expense? Only if the person chooses to replace the property.
Yes.
But what if they don't? Then it's just a loss, right? I mean, it's not exactly, in other words, the paradigm that they're all expenses doesn't quite hold true for the first one, which is loss of or damage to property.
Yes, but as a term by replacement cost, so to me it would seem that it would either be the replacement cost or the actual or estimated cost of repair. So that is basically an expense to the individual. That's what they're trying to compensate for. Even if the person who gets the money doesn't specifically use it to repair that item that was damaged, I think it's specifically limited to basically an expense.
If your argument is that lost wages are difficult to verify, what about, and what if she would call in sick anyway, et cetera? What about funeral and burial expenses? Do you think that everybody gets funds from friends and relatives? Would that be just as difficult to verify what the actual expense is when people give you funds to help cover the costs of funeral and burial expenses? Wouldn't that be just as difficult?
I'm sorry, so your argument is that sometimes grants help to cover funeral expenses?
I'm actually not arguing, I'm just asking you.
I apologize.
Yeah.
I just want, so your question is, if friends give a person money to cover the cost of funeral expenses?
Friends, and you'll say that in Hawaii, it's a relatively common occurrence that friends and relatives give money in the event of a death to help cover funeral expenses. I mean, funeral and burial expenses. Wouldn't that be just on a par insofar as the quantum of proof required as it is to determine the cost of the actual lost wages?
I believe respectfully it is a little bit different for those kinds of expenses. You're going to have receipts, you're going to have the maybe checks, things that you wrote.
And actually, wouldn't you just be taking the person's word for how much money they got? And that would also not be, in your view, verifiable if a person said, I received altogether $1,000. Would you say that in funds from friends and family? Would you say that's not enough to verify that that's the amount they received? Or would you require something more? It's only a person's word, similar to the victim's word here.
Mm-hmm. I'm very sorry. If I just can try to explain. So the person received $1,000 from friends to pay for medical expenses.
No,
I'm sorry.
For funeral
expenses. Okay, so that person would still have to have documentation of the funeral expenses, how much it costs, where.
Sure. Well,
so I think that is what would be submitted to the rest, should be submitted to try to recover her restitution or something of that nature.
So if it's money that was expended, that the defendant would be required to provide restitution, an exact accounting would be required and in paper. But if it's an amount of money that would lessen the amount that the defendant would have to prove to pay back, meaning money that would defray the cost, somebody's word would be enough on that?
Is there a difference between writing a check when somebody has a funeral to the person and writing a check to the funeral's home?
Yes, there is a difference in that. Having a check to a funeral home is plainly the purpose. It shows what the purpose is used for. A check just being written to an individual, we don't know what the purpose would be for. I think if a victim wanted to recover her funeral and burial expenses, they would submit either copies of checks or receipts or
And would they need to deduct what they received from friends and well-wishers? Does the collateral source rule apply in restitution?
Reasonable and verified losses is a direct. Well, that's under Tau'ili'ili. That might not be the case anymore. Tau'ili'ili says that even if there's an insurance, if there's an award from insurance, then the defendant is
So in this case, the victim could have claimed for the entire medical bill instead of just her out-of-pocket?
Under Tau'ili'i, that the victim could have done so.
So, but that would be reasonable and verified losses, even if it's not an expense.
I'm sorry?
In other words, under Tau'ili'i, if insurance is not considered, in other words, the collateral source rule under the civil context applies in restitution, restitution, which is a quasi-civil remedy, then we don't need to consider collateral sources. And in this case, like, the victim could have claimed her entire medical expense, right? And we don't even have to worry about whether or not she has sick leave or work comp or TDI, because those are collateral sources.
Under Tau'ili'i, that may be the case. We believe you could narrow it. Here, though, with respect to the loss of income, it must be reasonable and verifiable, or loss of income, loss of wages. So you would have to consider not just the gross amount, but the net amount or anything like that. And then under our opinion, it's very difficult to do in these situations for a criminal court, which is burdened already with many trials, many caseloads, to have full-blown restitution hearings for any time that a person is seeking loss of wages is entirely difficult. One of the purposes of...
Let me ask you something. When the legislature was considering this in 1998, they made a determination, it appears, that, look, this is an area that is very, very difficult. We're talking about people who are unemployed. Is there anything in the legislative history that indicates, well, we want to allow it in some cases, but we don't want to allow it in other cases? That's what seems to be one of the suggestions today, is that the legislature may have wanted to take an intermediate approach and therefore would have allowed a court to decide to granted in some situations lost wages and not in others? Is there anything like that in the legislative history?
Grant restitution for some cases and not.
Grant restitution for wages in some situations and for lost wages or lost income in some situations and not in others. Is there anything like that in the legislative history?
I don't believe
it. Okay, they took it out entirely. And secondly, on the reasonable and verifiable, is there anything to indicate that they want the courts to go through a complicated hearing, trying to make an estimation of what the future would be, and then decide at the end of it whether it is or is not verifiable, and then have whatever they've decided, whether it's 90% verifiable or 95% verifiable, and then have that whole matter appealed to the appellate courts for us to make an independent determination on every one of these cases?
But the statute actually doesn't say verifiable. It says verified, right? Doesn't that connote past expenses?
Well, that does, but if you read CVCC, that says loss of earning power.
And right, but we're not dealing with a CVCC situation here.
Okay, so we're just dealing
with... Well, I'm just saying if, in this case, we're not dealing with CVCC, right?
Verified is past tense, but we don't know when verified can be. Can it be verified at the time of the sentence when the defendant's found guilty, the time of the restitution hearing, or the time? It could be verified, just means verified at some point. We don't know when.
But wouldn't it presumably be at the time of the restitution hearing? I mean, that would be logical, right, that the court's making the call. And isn't the fact that the word used was verified as opposed to verifiable consistent with the view that the legislature intended to exclude complex speculative future damages or future earning capacity types of calculations, but left the door open for clear cases where someone is able to come in and document a wage loss?
I don't believe so. I think when they talk about the legislative history, when they discuss wage loss, they weren't making a distinction between future or past.
Well, actually, the House report said, wage loss may be measurable if the victim has an occupation at the time of the offense, but it becomes difficult to determine if the victim is unemployed at the time. Now, when the House Judiciary wrote that, they're clearly understanding or recognizing that there are categories of difference or differences in complexity in the calculations. And I guess the question would be, when the conference committee later on added the word fully back in, can we look at this entire body of legislative history and understand or somehow try to harmonize the fact that they put the word fully in and understand or come to some suggestion that perhaps they were contemplating that certain categories of verified losses could be covered?
I think that, with all respect, I think that's putting too much weight on the word fully. They didn't include lost wages or anything in the conference committee when they put that back in. It says allowing restitution for therapy and wage loss presents difficulty because these costs are often immeasurable. And then it says those other expenses can be determined with specificity. Wage loss may be measurable if the victim has an occupation, but it's difficult to determine if the victim is unemployed. Maybe measurable, but even still, that's not, they took the entire statute, that's the entire language out. If they wanted to say, oh, if the person has a job, then they can determine wage loss, they would have been expressly put that in the language of the statute. So I don't think that there's a way to harmonize the legislative intent to say that wage loss should be allowed if it's documented and verified. And even if the court does conclude that the legislative history is ambiguous, then the doctrine of lenity does support the construction that since it's not enumerated, wage loss should not be ordered. But the argument with respect to the C, because the CBCC refers to loss of earning power, then that should actually be included in the restitution statute, that's kind of flawed. Loss of earning power, as defined by Black's Law Dictionary, isn't lost wages, it's loss of future earnings. And if the legislature, so it's entirely speculative to say loss of future earnings, that would require, in the civil arena, that would require a lot of work to try to determine. Finally, if I may, if there's no more questions with respect to restitution. Oh, there's also a big distinction between CBCC and restitution. Under the CBCC, the defendant isn't given notice. He doesn't have to appear. It's just based on the documentation. The losses are capped, and they can hire a doctor. It's very different in the restitution. And finally, it's not reasonable and verified in this case because there is no specific documentation showing her amount of losses, the amount of income that she received previously, that she didn't put these people back in, and things like that. And as Justice Pollack stated, all of the other reasons. Finally, we just respectfully request the court to consider to clarify what could be seen as a burden shifting. The ICA cited People v. Fulton, which is a California case. California law is very different than Hawaii. They have an entire Bill of Rights for crime victims. Their statute is based on restitution based on what the loss is claimed by the victim, not reasonably verified. So if you can just clarify that there's no burden shifting, that if the state proves reasonable and verified restitution, burden doesn't shift to the defendant to put on evidence. That could be read as saying that the defendant must hire doctors or employers or something like that, and which would be very difficult to do. And does anyone have any other? One more thing. So with respect to Gaylord, relied on heavily on the Sentencing Commission, and there specifically they said that that wage loss should not be allowed. That Sentencing Commission expressly said the computation of more exotic damages, however, is removed from the normal business of the criminal courts and would require an expansion of the existing process, including full discovery and a lengthening of the sentencing hearing. Gaylord heavily relied on that Sentencing Commission, 1993 Sentencing Commission, when determining that restitution was quasi-civil in nature. Similarly, that same Sentencing Commission says that loss of wages, lost profits should not be allowed. I thank you for your time. I apologize.
No, not at all. Did you have an adequate time to wrap up, or does that summarize where you were?
That summarizes.
Okay, very well. Thank you. Mr. Boxa.
Your Honors, I had...
Oh, I see the red light is on.
I had spoken... I'm sorry. I had taken an extended time during the first time around. I think I have conveyed the position of the state sufficiently enough. Thank you. I have nothing to add.
Okay. Well, could you... How do you address Gaylord?
Beg your pardon?
How do you distinguish Gaylord that defense counsel just cited to?
I did not get the full question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you have any position, or would you be able to distinguish, how would you argue against the State versus Gaylord case that the defense counsel just referred to?
How would I argue about the legislative position in this case?
That's okay. Well, I'll just go ahead and read the case again, so it's fine. Thank you.
I just want to emphasize that the final conference committee reinserted the word fully. That is a very telling, that is very telling to us.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Boxa. Thank you, Ms. Stanley. The court will take this matter under advisement.